Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the September 25th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows fires burning on the hillsides off in the background. The sky has an orange glow to it. In the foreground is the scene of a burned out house. You can see the shell of a car. The chimney is the only thing remaining from the house. And in the very foreground, sitting on a piece of rubble, is a woman. She's wearing shorts, t-shirt, flip-flops. She's got her arms folded on her knees and her head is bent down in between them. The headline is Apocalypse Now. Under an eerie red sky, wildfires turn the West into a hellscape. And that is the main story that we will start with today. Wildfires ravage the West Coast. What happened? Apocalyptic wildfires ripped through California, Oregon, and Washington this week, forcing hundreds of thousands of residents to evacuate as the infernos turned skies blood red across the West. At least 35 people have died and dozens more are missing in blazes that have so far scorched more than 5 million acres. California firefighters are now battling six of the 20 worst fires in the state's history. Billowing clouds of toxic smoke forced flights to be canceled and schools to be shuttered. And authorities from Los Angeles to Seattle urged residents to stay indoors to avoid breathing some of the planet's most polluted air. Scenes of devastation littered the Pacific Northwest. Small Oregon towns of Phoenix and Talent, home to 11,000 people combined, were reduced to ashes. "There's nothing to sift through," said Phoenix Councilman Stuart Warren. Chris Toft was racing to his family in Lyons, Oregon, when he found a badly burned woman in the road. He helped her into his car, apologizing that he had to keep driving to find his wife and son. "I am your wife," Angela Masso whispered back. President Trump diverted to California during a campaign trip, meeting with Governor Gavin Newsom and state officials who explained how climate change is fueling wildfires. "It will start getting cooler. Just you watch," Trump said. Democratic challenger Joe Biden said Trump's refusal to acknowledge man-made warming made him a climate arsonist. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported this week that the Northern Hemisphere had its hottest summer on record in 2020, while globally last month ranked as the second warmest August since records began in 1880. What the editorial said: "Blame disastrous forest mismanagement for this tragedy," said NationalReview.com. "Fire is a natural manager of forests, and in the pre-industrial era, more than 4 million acres burned in California annually. But in the 20th century, federal and state agencies put a monomaniacal emphasis on fire suppression, extinguishing even the smallest blazes. As a result, the overcrowded forest filled with dead trees have become literal tinderboxes. Western states could be doing more to make forests more resilient to wildfire," said the Los Angeles Times. "Yet spending big on forest management while ignoring climate change, or making it worse, as Trump is doing by aggressively promoting the use of fossil fuels, is an exercise in futility. The number of days with extreme wildfire weather in California has more than doubled since the early 1980s, largely due to rising temperatures. If greenhouse gas emissions keep rising, studies show the average area burned statewide could increase 77% by the end of the century. What the columnist said, everyone agrees that controlled burns can reduce wildfires, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. So why has California done so little of it? Part of it is a not-in-my-backyard attitude from homeowners who don't want the nuisance of smoky air and charred landscapes. Some environmentalists also suspect that any attempt to thin a forest is a Trojan horse for logging companies to exploit natural resources. In their misguided attempt to protect nature, these activists cause far more environmental harm. Life out west is now almost too much to bear, said Emma Maris in TheAtlantic.com. In my southern Oregon town, everyone checks air quality apps on their phone constantly, and my brother in Seattle wears a particulate respirator while he works in nearly 90-degree heat. People come to this part of the country because of its vastness. Now we are prisoners in our homes, trapped by the pandemic and air visibly thick with incinerated pines and firs. It's hard to explain the experience of having the world immolate before your eyes, said Charlie Warzel in the New York Times. While no region has a monopoly on climate-related disasters, I can't help but wonder if more Americans would feel an urgency about climate change if they could experience a wildfire. Unlike a storm that barrels through, the encroaching infernos descend for days, weeks, even months. You live with end-of-the-world skies and soot everywhere. It takes a psychological toll, one that makes it difficult to see a healthy future for the earth through all the smoke. Before we leave the page, we'll read a It Wasn't All Bad piece. There's an adorable picture of a lamb and a duck snuggling up together, and the story goes, an extraordinary friendship has developed at a farm sanctuary in New Jersey. Merlin, a duck with a leg injury that prevents him from walking, was sunbathing on the grass when friendly seven-month-old lamb Gigi curled up next to him. She visited him again the next day and the next, and soon the two were snuggling and grooming each other daily. Such interspecies friendships are rare at the sanctuary, but Gigi makes an effort, said founder Leanne Laricella. It's like she is trying to comfort him. The farm has seen many precious moments among its herd of blind and disabled animals, said Laricella. But this relationship is very special. Controversy of the week is titled, Trump, does he have contempt for American troops? The courage it takes to fight and die for your country is hard for many civilians to comprehend, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. President Trump marvels at it too, apparently, just not in a complimentary way. A recent bombshell story in The Atlantic reports that Trump has repeatedly startled aides by describing U.S. troops who have died for their country as suckers and losers. During an Armistice Day memorial in France in 2018, the White House publicly blamed poor flying conditions for his skipping a ceremony at a cemetery filled with American soldiers. In private, multiple sources would say, Trump was worried the wind and rain would leave his hair disheveled in front of cameras and asked why he should visit a cemetery filled with losers. Trump once accompanied then-Secretary of Homeland Security General John Kelly to Arlington National Cemetery, and at the grave of Kelly's son killed in Afghanistan, told Kelly directly, I don't get it. What was in it for them? White House insiders were understandably unwilling to go on record, said Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, but several said the draft-dodging, money-obsessed Trump simply does not understand non-transactional life choices and nurses a deep cynicism about heroism and sacrifice. Trump quickly trashed the Atlantic story as fake news, said DeRoy Murdoch in Spectator.us. And the facts back him up. The cloud ceiling that day in France was treacherously low, and military officials were dead set against Trump's flying. To have driven instead, as other world leaders did, could have meant he'd spend 2 hours each way stuck in traffic. Not an option for the commander of the world's largest nuclear arsenal. The claims of Atlantic's four anonymous sources have now been disputed, on the record, by 11 current or former Trump staffers, said Kaylee McGee in WashingtonExaminer.com. Why believe this gossipy tidbit when no sources will put their names to it? Here's a named source. Donald J. Trump, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Throughout his life, Trump has expressed public contempt and bewilderment for those who choose military service over chasing riches, with his harshest epithet, loser, reserved for those like George H.W. Bush and John McCain who were shot down and or captured. The Atlantic's reporting has since been confirmed by the Washington Post, the New York Times, and even Fox News. And it only adds to last year's unchallenged reports that Trump mocked his own generals to their faces as dopes and babies. Trump's panicked defenders are denying comments that are only incrementally worse than what he said in public. Maybe Trump did say those things, said Jeff Groom in the AmericanConservative.com. But the president's crassness and superficial callousness are hardly news at this point. What matters more to our troops are his actions. Defense spending has increased each of Trump's 3 years in office, and Trump has honored his campaign promise not to send our soldiers into new foreign entanglements. Sorry, said retired Colonel Jeff McCausland in NBCNews.com, but our troops and their families deserve leadership that understands military service and truly cares about their welfare. This president doesn't care that Russia is paying the Taliban to kill Americans, praises war criminals as heroes, and uses highly respected generals like John Kelly, James Mattis, and H.R. McMaster as props, only to discard and denigrate them. It's time for these generals to tell Americans on the record whether the Atlantic story is true. Their silence right now is truly deafening. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for disarming. After a Florida man bought a musket used in the Civil War in an online auction and found that the weapon was loaded. It could have gone off and killed somebody, said John Pisano, and I guess that person would have been a victim of the Civil War. It was a good week for audiophiles, with the news that vinyl records outsold compact discs in the first half of 2020 for the first time since the 1980s. Overall, vinyl sales are up more than 4% over 2019, while revenue from CDs plunged by 48%. And it was a good week for narcissism, after Madonna announced she was co-writing and directing a new biopic on her own roller coaster life. Who better to tell it than me, she said. But it was a bad week for humans after TheGuardian.com published an unsettling essay written by GPT-3, a language-generating artificial intelligence program. GPT-3 assures readers that eradicating humanity seems like a rather useless endeavor for AI machines, since people will keep doing what they have been doing, hating and fighting each other. It's a bad week for creativity after Daniel Snyder, owner of the NFL team formerly known as the Washington Redskins, said the current placeholder name, the Washington Football Team, may become permanent if the name catches on and our fans embrace it. Finally, it was a bad week for useful idiots. After former Ukrainian parliamentarian Andriy Derkach, who had been feeding dirt on Joe and Hunter Biden to Rudy Giuliani, was identified by the U.S. Treasury Department as an active Russian agent, Julian explained. There is nothing I saw that said he was a Russian agent. And a short news piece before we move on. Census must include unauthorized migrants. The three-judge panel in a New York City federal courthouse last week threw out President Trump's bid to exclude undocumented immigrants from a critical census count that will be used to apportion seats in the House of Representatives next year. The ruling found that Trump's July executive order violated the Constitution's edict that House apportionment be based on the whole number of persons in each state and that only one official tally be conducted of each state's population. Trump had ordered that two counts, one excluding unauthorized immigrants, be conducted. The decision came less than a week after a federal judge in California issued a temporary restraining order blocking the administration from winding down the census efforts a month earlier than originally planned. We're on the briefing page with a story titled, The COVID Long Haulers. Even after supposedly recovering, thousands of Americans are suffering persistent and even disabling symptoms. What is long-haul COVID? It's a persistent and wide-ranging set of symptoms that follow a coronavirus infection. Nearly 100 kinds of lingering symptoms and physical damage have been cataloged, including scarred lungs, chronic heart damage, severe headaches, kidney failure, bulging veins, hand tremors, debilitating fatigue, fever, nausea, stomach problems, hair loss, sensitivity to light and sound, blurry vision, loss of taste and smell, short-term memory loss, and a brain fog so dense it can be difficult to write even a simple email. New York City resident Deborah Kopakin, 54, was diagnosed with COVID-19 in March and still suffers from shortness of breath and the repeated and sudden onset of a rapid heartbeat so severe that she must lie down in order to avoid passing out. A few weeks ago, she said, I stood up to make a smoothie and my heart rate zoomed from a lying in the hammock to booming bass drum. David Putrino, a neuroscientist at Mount Sinai Hospital who has treated many long haulers, said his patients struggle with a bewildering array of maladies. It's like every day you reach your hand into a bucket of symptoms, throw some on the table, and say, this is you for today. What is causing these symptoms? Researchers indicate that the coronavirus is far more than a classic respiratory illness and can attack organs throughout the body. The virus binds itself to cells using a protein on the surface of the cells called ACE2. These ACE2 receptors are found inside blood vessels, on olfactory bulbs that provide a sense of smell, on kidneys, in the gastrointestinal tract, and, according to new research, in the brain. The immune system's overreaction to the viral invasion can compound the damage, with severe inflammation and blood clots impairing the heart, lungs, and other organs. It's amazing how many different ways it affects the body, said Thomas McGinn, deputy physician in chief at Northwell Health. If the virus penetrates the brain, a new study found, it replicates and starves nearby cells of oxygen, diminishing the number of synapses, connections between neurons. We don't know yet if that is reversible or not, said Dr. Allison Mutri, a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Diego. These findings may explain why 40 to 60% of hospitalized COVID-19 patients experience psychiatric and neurological symptoms, including brain fog, delirium, crippling headaches, anxiety, and depression. Are long haulers generally old? Unlike the majority of people whom COVID kills, Many long haulers are relatively young. Putrino's survey of 1,400 patients found that they are mostly female and have an average age of 44. Some were previously quite healthy and fit. Isabella Power, for example, is 22 and used to work out 4 to 5 times a week. She developed COVID symptoms 6 months ago in Barcelona and today labors to brush her teeth. My whole body feels like very weighted down, said the Cleveland area resident. I'm almost dragging myself around places. Like many long haulers, she faced strong skepticism from doctors who doubted that she was really sick. I ended up like just kind of losing faith in getting any help at all, she said. How many long haulers are there? Probably millions worldwide. A study in Italy found that 87% of COVID patients who were hospitalized still had symptoms 2 months after their release. A British study followed up with COVID patients 8 to 12 weeks after hospitalization and found 74% still had persistent symptoms, particularly fatigue and shortness of breath. In Germany, researchers found 78% of patients, including some who had recovered at home, suffered from heart abnormalities 2 to 3 months after their recovery. Meanwhile, researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tracked 270 COVID patients who were not hospitalized and found that 95, more than a third, hadn't fully gotten better within 3 weeks. The U.S. has had about 6.5 million confirmed cases, so the math points to hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions of long haulers. Are all cases equal? No, there is a wide variation in severity. In milder cases, a handful of symptoms inexplicably come and go for months. In more severe cases, like Shamari Smith's, it becomes impossible to work. Smith, a middle school English teacher in Baltimore, has had COVID symptoms since March, including severe stomach problems and headaches, and has been to the emergency room a dozen times. Once highly verbal, she struggles with a chronic mental fog that makes it difficult for her to remember words or speak in complex sentences. Who in the world would want to live like this, Smith said. I wanted to jump out of my own body. Hannah Y., 30, an Ottawa-based product designer, gradually overcame her neurological symptoms, but not the scarred lungs that have diminished her ability to exercise or even walk up a flight of stairs. Will I be living with this lasting damage, she asked, or will it eventually go away? I don't have the answers, and no one can tell me. Sick, but never diagnosed. Many COVID long haulers complained that they were denied tests early on in the pandemic because of shortages of diagnostic swabs and restrictions placed on who was eligible for scarce tests. Boston resident Lauren Nichols, 32, got sick in March, but was denied a test by her doctor, who said at her age she was in no danger. She finally tested positive and has suffered a debilitating array of symptoms consistent with those experienced by other long haulers, including nausea, brain fog, insomnia, and shortness of breath. Complicating matters, said neuroscientist David Putrino, 2/3 of the 1,400 patients he studied did not test positive for COVID antibodies. Some, like Nichols, tested negative for antibodies even after testing positive for the virus itself. That can make it difficult for the afflicted to prove they have COVID and get paid time off work or qualify for disability benefits. Just because you're negative for antibodies, Putrino says, doesn't mean you didn't have COVID 19. Few of the best columns of the week, starting with Trump allies openly call for violence. If President Trump loses the election, it will be because it was stolen, and his supporters should respond to the coup with violence. This, said Jamel Bowie, is what Trump's most ardent supporters and the president himself are saying as polls show him trailing Democrat Joe Biden. This week, Michael Caputo, the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Health and Human Services, claimed that Biden and the Democrats will try to seize power through election fraud. When Donald Trump refuses to stand down at the inauguration, Caputo warned on a video posted on Facebook, the shooting will begin. He recommended buying ammunition now because it's going to be hard to get. Trump confidant and convicted felon Roger Stone is urging the president to declare martial law and seize ballots, while Trump himself recently said, the only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged. He said that if there is insurrection by his opponents after the election, he'll put it down. Trump has made it very clear he knows he may lose, so he is openly campaigning to hold on to power by any means necessary. If you think this is all ranting and raving, you haven't been paying attention the last 4 years. Read a couple of international columns this week. This is from the Middle East. Why Arab nations are embracing Israel. The Arab world is abandoning the Palestinian cause, said Yusuf Rizka in the Gaza-based Palestine. First, the United Arab Emirates established full diplomatic relations with Israel. That was a clear violation of the 2002 Saudi Arabian-led Arab Peace Initiative, under which most Arab nations agreed that ties with Israel would be normalized only following the creation of a viable Palestinian state. Then last week, Bahrain announced that it, too, was normalizing relations with the Jewish state. It's only a matter of time before more countries join this shameful procession. Rumor has it that Oman, Kuwait, Sudan, and Morocco might follow suit. At an Arab League summit last week, Palestinian officials put forward a resolution to condemn the U.S. brokered deal between Israel and the UAE, but the Saudis and others refused to pass it. Palestinian leaders can no longer rely on traditional allies. To achieve statehood, we will have to activate popular resistance to the Israeli oppressors. Solidarity with the Palestinians has been trumped by the promise of advanced American weapons, said Creed Newton in AlJazeera.com. The UAE had long wanted to buy F-35 fighter jets and larger drones from the U.S., partly to contain the threat posed by Iran. But the U.S. refused to sell because of a pledge to ensure Israel retained a military advantage in the Middle East. The Trump administration said it would drop its objection if the UAE struck a diplomatic deal with Israel, and now the sale is on track. Bahrain likely also agreed to normalization to get access to advanced weaponry, and the Saudis could potentially follow. Our Palestinian partners need to rethink their dysfunctional approach to the peace process, said Faisal Abbas in Arab News. For decades, Palestinian leaders have said no to every peace offer from Israel. When will they learn that every time they turn away from the negotiating table, the pie only gets smaller? At this point, while the loss of historical Palestine is tragic, we must all put emotions to one side and embrace the reality. That doesn't mean Arab nations will give up on the struggle for a Palestinian state, but working with Israel rather than against it might bring better results. The UAE and Saudi Arabia regard Palestinians as nothing more than pawns in their push for regional dominance, said Al-Quds Al-Arabi in an editorial. There are reports that the UAE is now negotiating with President Mahmoud Abbas, promising to help his West Bank-based Palestinian Authority take control of the Gaza Strip, currently led by a rival Palestinian faction, Hamas. If he restarts peace talks with Israel, This scheme will likely involve Riyadh and Abu Dhabi providing the Palestinian Authority with funds and weapons, and perhaps mercenaries. The Saudis and the UAE are already involved in bloody civil wars in Yemen, where they're fighting Iran-linked militias, and Libya, where they're battling the Turkey-allied government in Tripoli. Will they now turn the Palestinian territories into a war zone? And this comes from Russia. The meaning of Navalny's poisoning. The attempted murder of Alexei Navalny marks the beginning of a dark new era in Russia, said Alexander Bonov. The opposition leader was evacuated to a hospital in Germany late last month after falling critically ill on a flight from Siberia to Moscow. Navalny spent weeks in a medically induced coma, regaining consciousness only last week. German authorities believe he was poisoned with Novichok, the same nerve agent used against turncoat spy Sergei Skripal in England in 2018. But Navalny's poisoning stands apart from previous assassination attempts, in which the Kremlin was accused of having a hand. Skripal, who survived, and Alexander Litvinenko, killed with polonium in London in 2006, were exiles targeted in a foreign land and unknown to Russians and foreigners alike before their poisonings. Navalny, by contrast, is famous at home and abroad. As former security service members, Skripal and Litvinenko may have been seen as defectors deserving punishment. Navalny's poisoning erases the line drawn by the regime of President Vladimir Putin between enemies and traitors, the former being deserving of respect. With daily anti-corruption protests in Russia's Far East and a pro-democracy uprising raging in neighboring Belarus, the Putin regime surely feels more endangered than ever. No threat to its survival, domestic or foreign, will now be tolerated. Time for the last word, our in-depth feature article, Looking Inside the Injured Brain. Doctors can analyze the brains of dead athletes to confirm football-linked brain injuries, said Patrick Herbie in the Washington Post magazine. But what about a test for the living? Red and yellow were bad. Blue and green were good. The rest, Sam Gandy explained, remains unclear. It was December 2015, and Gandy, a neurologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, was showing a former National Football League player named Sean Morey scans of his brain. A professional athlete for 10 seasons, Morey retired from the NFL in 2010 after doctors told him he had suffered too many concussions. At 39 years old, he was also suffering debilitating headaches, memory lapses, angry outbursts, and other symptoms associated with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, a neurodegenerative disease linked to repeated blows to the head. While CTE had been found in the brains of dozens of former players, including Pro Football Hall of Fame members Mike Webster and Junior Sal, there was no way to know whether Morey had it. The disease could be diagnosed only posthumously. Gandy was working to change that. To try to identify CTE, he was using an experimental technique to scan the brains of retired football players and soldiers. The scans were color-coded. Healthy brains appeared mostly blue and green, like grassy islands surrounded by sea. By contrast, probable areas of damage look yellow and red, as if fires were burning on those same islands. The images Gandy was showing Morey were the result of brain scans done 7 months earlier using a positron emission tomography, PET, machine. Much of Maury's brain was green, but some areas were red, bright, flaming red. And those areas correspond to the damaged areas found in the autopsied brains of Soe, Webster, and others with CTE. "I knew they would find something," Maury said later. "The question was, what was the extent of it?" Suppose you're a football player. Here's what happens when doctors suspect that you've torn a knee ligament. They use a magnetic resonance imaging machine, MRI, to look at the tissues in your leg, determine whether and how they've been damaged, and use that information to prescribe a course of treatment and recovery. Here's what happens when doctors suspect you're suffering from CTE. They wait for you to die. After that, they carefully remove your brain from your skull, slice portions of it into small, thin pieces, stain those pieces with special chemicals, and place them under microscopes to look for the disease's biological signature, tangles of a toxic, abnormal variation of a protein called tau in the depths of the sulci, which are the crevices between the brain's many wrinkles. Then, and only then, can it be said conclusively that you had CTE and not some other neurodegenerative disease or type of brain injury. Linked to aggression, depression, suicidal thoughts, impaired judgment, impulse control problems, and dementia, CTE was found in the brain of Tyler Helinski, a 21-year-old Washington State University quarterback who died of suicide in 2018, and in the brain of Aaron Hernandez, a 27-year-old former NFL player who in 2017 hanged himself in prison while serving a life sentence for murder. Last year, Boston University researchers found that for football players, both the risk of developing the disease and its severity increase with the number of years playing the sport. Athletes whose youth-to-pro career lasted more than 14 and a half years were 10 times as likely to have CTE as those who played fewer. Yet because there's no way to identify the disease in the living, many basic and important questions remain unanswered. Researchers do not know why some people who suffer repeated head hits develop CTE, while others do not. They do not know how many hits are too many. They do not know exactly how the disease first arises or how and why it spreads across the brain over time. They do not know why individuals develop different symptoms with different levels of severity. Moreover, the inability to detect the disease in people such as Maury makes developing effective therapies almost impossible. But with detection, we'd be able to begin clinical trials for new compounds to be able to treat the disease once it starts, and hopefully even prevent it if we can detect it early on, says Robert Stern, the director of clinical research for Boston University's CTE Center and an expert on the disease. So the next critical step is to diagnose it during life. Maury never planned to become a medical case study. Undersized at 5'11" and 193 pounds, he played his way from practice squads to the 2008 Pro Bowl as a special teams standout for the Arizona Cardinals. After football, Maury figured he would put his Brown University degree to use and become an athletic director, or perhaps go into politics. Brain injuries derailed those ambitions. Maury estimates that he suffered more than 20 concussions over his career, most of them undiagnosed, and countless other blows to the head. After the 2009 season, he began having blind spots in his vision and excruciating headaches that would leave him immobilized for hours at a time. When two doctors advised Maury to retire in the summer of 2010, he knew enough to take their advice. 2 years earlier at the Super Bowl, he'd had a long conversation with Chris Nowinski, a former Harvard University football player and professional wrestler, who was trying to warn the sports world about the potential dangers of concussions and repetitive brain trauma, including CTE. Maury was a quick study. He co-chaired the NFL Players Association's first brain injury committee and recruited scientists to advise it. He read every study he could get his hands on and co-wrote a 90-page report outlining players' health risk. In 2011 negotiations between the league and the union, he helped create a return-to-play protocol for players who have concussions and helped secure more than $300 million in new funding for player health and research. Morey later resigned from the union committee because he believed the programs the union chose to spend that money on did not adequately study or treat retirees who have brain injuries. All the while, Morey's own symptoms were intensifying. His headaches, he said, felt like someone is squeezing your eyeballs together. At his daughter's sports practices, Morey says, he would show up and introduce myself and ask other parents their names, and they would look at me like I'm crazy because I take them to practice every week, and I'm asking every week. Worse still were the explosions of rage. In locker rooms, Morey took pride in being calm and thoughtful. Now he was erupting at his wife, Kara, and their three young daughters, dropping F-bombs and screaming at the top of my lungs, he says. The fallout left Morey confused and ashamed. I would think to myself, what the F did I just say? He says, how can I do this? 5 years ago, when Gandy first saw the images of Morey's brain scans, a single thought went through his mind. That's it. That's CTE. The scans were negative for beta amyloid, which is associated with Alzheimer's and can result in similar symptoms, and positive for p-tau. Gandy could see clearly that the p-tau in Morey's brain was concentrated in the areas associated with the disease. I was amazed, Gandy said. Ensuing research, though, has produced a more complicated picture. Since 2016, Gandy and his team have scanned and examined 25 combat veterans and 25 former collision sport athletes. Of the 20 patients suffering clinical symptoms associated with CTE, 16 have scans showing excess retention of the tracer that indicates tau tangles. However, Gandy says, the positives were in people who had obvious symptoms, who already had seen a neurologist or a psychiatrist and were being medicated, he says. So is this technique sensitive enough to see if you have a lower level of p-tau or early CTE? Would it be useful in screening NCAA football players? Probably unlikely. A 2019 Boston University scanning study that compared 26 former NFL players suffering from symptoms associated with CTE and 31 people with no history of head injuries or symptoms was similarly suggestive and similarly inconclusive. Stern, the Boston University researcher and one of the study's co-authors, believes that the tracer used to detect p-tau, a compound called flortacipir, may prove inadequate for a reliable CTE test. If a better test is developed, doctors still will need to scan a large number of suspected CTE patients, track them over time, and examine them after death to validate that the yellow and red areas seen in the scans correspond to what's actually inside their brains. That process probably will take years. But Stern wants to speed things up. He is heading the largest and most thorough study designed to identify CTE in living people. The 7-year, $16 million project has put 180 former NFL and college football players and 60 non-contact sport control subjects through a series of tests, including two PET scans. Two other types of imaging, blood, saliva, and spinal fluid collection, genetic evaluations, neuropsychological testing, and clinical examinations and histories. One of the study's goals is to use imaging and other biomarkers to create a detection toolkit for CTE. If a scan alone isn't enough to diagnose the disease, then perhaps a scan plus, say, high levels of a chemical in the blood that indicates brain trauma will be. It's a long road, Stern says. The more neuroscience moves forward making discoveries about the brain, the more we realize how complex it is. On a cool, sunny Saturday afternoon last fall, Maury stood on the sideline at the Lawrenceville school in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, holding a kickoff coverage play sheet he designed. Since 2016, he has been an assistant football coach at the private prep school, which has been playing the sport since the 1800s. Outside the Lawrenceville locker room, players lined up to take the field. It was senior day. "Let's do it one more time," someone yelled. What Maury loved most about football was community, the relationships with teammates and coaches, the shared sense of sacrifice, the pursuit of a common goal. Brain injuries often have left him isolated. Over time and by himself, Maury has shuffled through doctors and medications, searching for relief. Today, brain injury specialists have prescribed him a stimulant for focus, an antidepressant that he says lengthens the fuse on his blow-ups, and a blood pressure medication that softens his migraines. He spends roughly $20,000 a year on treatment. "Maybe the hardest thing about his condition," Maury says, "is its invisibility. When you have a bum knee, others can see the swelling in the joint, the brace around your leg, the crutches you're using to get around. Nobody says that you're faking a limp or that your inability to climb stairs is all in your head. Not so with a battered brain." After Maury retired from football, a neurologist who examined him in 2012 for a workers' compensation claim concluded that Maury's problems were substantially, if not completely, the result of his psychological state and not the result of brain damage from getting hit in the head. The neurologist based that conclusion in part on MRI, an electroencephalogram, EEG, scans of Maury's brain that did not confirm the presence of a structural brain injury. But those types of scans are less sensitive than the ones used by Gandy and Stern. Similarly, the league's concussion settlement, which covers about 2,500 retired players, only pays CTE claims to the families of players posthumously diagnosed with the disease between 2006 and April 2015. It also does not compensate mood and behavior disorders associated with CTE. Lawyers who negotiated the deal said it was the best they could do, given that the disease cannot be diagnosed in the living. So much of the imaging that was discussed or debated or referenced for years and years was simply not sensitive enough to identify the damage that players had been sustaining, Maury said. Doctors and lawyers could point to that and suggest there were no long-term outcomes from football, even though guys were suffering. There must have been so many people experiencing these issues that were painted as bulls or crazy. "Don't effing call us crazy. We're not crazy. We're hurting, and we need help." A version of this story appeared in the Washington Post magazine. Got one of the obituaries for you this week. The Mets ace who steered a miracle, Tom Seaver, 1944 to 2020. Tom Seaver was the most valuable player on the 1969 Miracle Mets and one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history. When the 22-year-old Seaver joined the New York Mets in 1967, the franchise was a laughingstock and had never finished higher than ninth in the 10-team National League. But with his blazing fastball, wicked slider, and famously cerebral approach to pitching, Seaver turned the Mets around. The ace threw an incredible 8 straight complete game victories as the Mets charged back from a 10-game deficit in August 1969 to make the playoffs, then bested the heavily favored Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. Over 20 seasons, Tom Terrific savored each of his 311 wins. "People ask me after a shutout, was that fun?" he said in 1981. "No, it was not fun, because fun is such a minuscule word for the satisfaction of what I'm doing." The pitcher grew up in farm country in Fresno, California, where his father was in the raisin business, said the Los Angeles Times. Seaver played baseball in high school, but got no college scholarship offers because he was too small. So enrolled in the Marine Corps Reserve, where in 6 months he went from 5'9", 160 pounds, to 6'1", 210 pounds, and started throwing 90 miles per hour fastballs. After 2 seasons at the University of Southern California, Seaver signed with the Mets, earning the nickname the Franchise on a club that went 61-101 in his rookie year. Seaver was both overpowering and crafty, said the Washington Post, with a drop-and-dive delivery that left dirt stains on his right knee. Sports writers referred to him as an artist on the mound. Seaver was the catalyst in 1969, said the New York Daily News, winning 25 games and earning his first of 3 Cy Young Awards. In Game 4 of the World Series, he pitched all 10 innings of a 2-1 victory. Fans went ballistic in 1974 when the Mets traded Seaver to the Cincinnati Reds after a heated contract dispute. He returned briefly to New York in 1983, then finished his career with the Chicago White Sox and Boston Red Sox. After retiring as a player in 1986, having clocked 3,640 career strikeouts, he became a longtime broadcaster for the Mets and New York Yankees. "God is a Met," he said during the remarkable 69 run. "I heard that somewhere. Now, I believe it." And we'll turn over to the Talking Points page to finish out the show today. Got an article here. NFL, will white fans accept player protest? 4 years after Colin Kaepernick took a knee, the NFL is seeking atonement, said Paul Newberry in the Associated Press. The league kicked off its season this week amid a pandemic and a nationwide social justice movement that saw Kansas City Chiefs players link arms in solidarity. "End racism" printed on the field, and "Lift Every Voice and Sing," a song sometimes called the Black National Anthem, added to the pregame program. Those symbolic statements brought some boos from the 17,000 socially distanced fans, illustrating the NFL's predicament. Can it support black players who are part of the Black Lives Matter movement without alienating white fans? The league is also walking the pandemic tightrope, testing players daily and keeping most stadiums empty or at very limited capacity in hope of preventing outbreaks. At this rate, the league won't need to prohibit fans from attending games, said Hugo Gurdon in WashingtonExaminer.com. America's game should be an escape from political exhibitionism, but the NFL has been cowed into adding virtue signaling graffiti about race relations on uniforms and playing fields. Football, President Trump said, is just not the same. Fans seem to agree. Ratings plummeted for an opening featuring the Super Bowl champion Chiefs, and viewership was mostly down Sunday. Black players demanded more from the league after George Floyd's killing by police, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com, and had to settle for some uncontroversial verbiage about how the NFL supports the ongoing fight for equality in this country. But even that was booed. So far, moments of unity are proving to be not all that uniting. Change won't happen overnight, said Jerry Brewer in WashingtonPost.com. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell recently acknowledged that Kaepernick was unfairly vilified for his decision to kneel during the national anthem to protest racism, and fans are more enlightened about the purpose of protest. 56% of Americans consider it appropriate for athletes to protest inequality by kneeling, according to a new poll. Although several team owners are staunch Trump supporters, most coaches and other team officials finally seem to empathize with the pain of black players who see African Americans their age dying in the streets. The NFL has been given a second chance to confront racial issues, and this reckoning won't go smoothly. Brace for a treacherous but revealing journey. And a few short notes here. A scientist with a history of disputing that human activity is driving climate change has been appointed to a top post at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which oversees federally funded climate research. New NOAA official David Liggates is affiliated with the conservative Heartland Institute and has had research funded by ExxonMobil and Koch Industries. Former Democratic presidential contender Mike Bloomberg will pour $100 million into the party's efforts in Florida to win the state for Joe Biden. Florida, which has 29 electoral votes and is often decided by close margins, is crucial to President Trump. No GOP nominee has won the presidency without Florida since 1924. And we'll finish out with a quote from comic Ricky Gervais, who says, "Saying atheism is a belief system is like saying not going skiing is a hobby." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program has been generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.